The Y Curve with Phil Dobby and Roger Hearing.
Are the Tories looking into an electoral abyss?
The local elections have confirmed the polling.
The political scenery has changed.
Labour are preparing for government.
But is it all a bit more nuanced than that?
Labour was hampered by Gaza.
The SNP have had a leadership crisis.
Reform polled big, but not enough to do more than rattle the Tory vote.
And the Lib Dems haven't gained as much from all this as they'd hoped.
So what is the new political landscape of the UK as we head towards a general election?
The Y Curve.
As we head towards a general election, sometime.
Well, no, we know it's when it's got to be by.
Well, yeah, by early next year.
Yeah, but I mean, the likelihood it's going to be November. That's what most people are suggesting.
Did you see? I don't know how old this clip was. I saw Rishi Sunak. I think it's since the polls last week, saying being interviewed by Beth Rigby on Sky.
Yeah,
and he was there saying, "You know, people don't want an election. What people want is a government that delivers results." Again, okay. And what's that got to do with you precisely? She was just there going, "You're running scared, aren't you? You're scared.
Of course she is. Well, he was talking about a hung parliament, but I mean, you'd have to really read the polls in a very strange way to see that as a likely outcome. No, I mean, I think you know...
That's a tactic, isn't it? Yeah. It's like if you say, well, it's going to be a hung parliament, then they're hoping that some people will go, oh, well, in that case, we were thinking we'd do a protest vote against Labour. But it's a trick as old as the hills, isn't it? It's like, look, it looks like we're not going to win, but we have a chance, so don't waste your vote on Labour. Vote for us because we are the safe managers of the economy.
I just don't think people think that way about voting at all. I think the vast majority of people probably vote the same way they always have and always will.
Yeah.
There will be some swinging across in different ways.
Well, more so this time than
probably
because there's so much going wrong.
Yeah, that's true.
Or a lot of people
just not voting at all, which I think is more likely. I mean, local elections, very few people vote anyway.
Yeah, so do we know how these compared, or is that a question for our guest today?
Well,
whether the local elections this time was at a poor turnout compared to previous local elections?
I think it was pretty normal. I think it's about 30% overall, that kind of thing. Slightly more in one of the mayoral elections.
Maybe this is Rishi's approach. He thinks if he can just get us all completely disenfranchised with the political process,
we'll
just go, whatever, it's only politics.
They had an election. We didn't notice, though. Yeah. We didn't turn out. Sorry.
I mean, maybe that's his technique. I mean,
it's possible. It's possible. I mean, basically what you've got is a situation where the Tories know what's coming down the road, what's their best option, to make it slightly less bad than it obviously is going to be. And that's... Well, you know, there's not a lot in that.
No.
The enthusiasm is not going to be there. So what are they doing and why are they doing it?
Yeah.
Well, let's talk to someone who does know about all this.
Well, he doesn't know the answers, but he can guide us in the right direction. Well, maybe he does.
Yes. Anyway, it's Tim Bale, Professor of Politics at Queen Mary University of London, who joins us now.
So, Tim, we were saying just before we started talking to you about whether, you know, the local turnout, whether that was normal, or are we getting a bit more disenfranchised with politics, and was this a lower turnout than normal, or are people so keen to see the back of Rishi that there's been a bigger turnout? How did this time compare with previous local elections?
No, I mean, it's basically par for the course. I mean, to use the nerdy political science language, these elections are second order elections, as we call them. And to be honest, turnout in the UK in those elections has always been quite low. It's true in European Parliament elections, remember those? Mm. But it's always been true in local elections. And this election cycle wasn't really any different.
Right.
You know, you rarely get more than, you know, a third of people out for a local election.
So doesn't that make it difficult to sort of extract any conclusions from it?
Well, that is why you have some serious number crunchers working for both Sky and for the BBC, trying to produce an equivalent share of the vote from a set of elections, which of course doesn't include the whole of the country and has some kind of quite weird local things going on. You may have seen, and listeners may have seen, that the share of the vote given to the Labour Party was actually a lot lower from their calculations than we're seeing in opinion polls at the moment. So Labour are on about sort of 35, 34 in their calculations. The Conservatives are on about 25. Now, the Conservatives on 25 is, you know, round about where they are in the opinion polls, but Labour in the opinion polls are normally cresting, you know, 43, 44%. Even then, I think we have to take that kind of, you know, national equivalent share that the number crunchers have come up with a pinch of salt.
It's certainly not the hung parliament
This is what Rishi was going on about, isn't it? That, yeah, we've got it's going to be a hung parliament, therefore vote for us because at least we'll be a solid government and we can carry on with the job.
Yeah, there's so many problems with that. And I'd like to, if I can, refer people to a really brilliant blog actually done by Peter Kellner, who used to run YouGov, former journalist as well. And he gives five reasons why Rishi Sunak is wrong about last week's election. The blog is called The Politics Counter, if anyone wants to go see it. But I mean, essentially what Peter argues or points out anyway is that that might be true on what we call a uniform national swing. So if the swing were to be the same right across the country, then maybe that's the case. But the fact is the swing won't be like that right across the country. It'll be quite different. And also, of course, it didn't take into account what's going on in Scotland, which is important. And the other thing to point out is actually, if you drill down into the results, you will see that Labour did better in places where it needs to flip constituencies from the Conservatives, and the Conservatives did worse in those constituencies that it really needs to hold on to. And the same is actually true for the Lib Dems as well. And there's a degree to which the results in London actually suggest quite a lot of tactical voting going on, because in London, there were people who had a choice both for the mayor and for the London Assembly. And you can see, when you look at the way that they voted, there were many Lib Dems who voted for Sadiq Khan in the mayoral elections, but actually voted for a Lib Dem in the London Assembly elections.
So, where they'd have a chance of actually getting people in.
Yeah, exactly.
So that suggests campaigning then. If they're doing well where they needed to do well and tactical voting was working to their benefit, then obviously they were pamphleting, they were out on the streets, they were door knocking, and that was working for them.
Yeah. I mean, I think it does suggest a degree of local activity paying off for them. But whatever, it suggests very worryingly for the Conservative Party that, you know, we're seeing what we saw back in 1997, which is, you know, the willingness on the part of people who would normally vote for the Lib Dems to vote for Labour, where they can get rid of a Conservative MP, and the same in the opposite direction from Labour Party supporters. And if that's the case, you know, we are talking real problems for the Tories.
Well, I remember 97. I actually swapped my vote with someone else in a different constituency on that very basis.
Right. So yes, of course. You know, there will be some people, sort of tech nerds, who are very keen on these sites that actually, you know, now sort of link you up with someone you can do that with in a way that was, you know, more informal back then.
Well, let's just stand back and look then, say, Tim, because as you say, you know, it's a distorting mirror to a large extent. But if we look at the political landscape as we begin the summer before the general election, possibly October, November, who knows, what has changed? I mean, you mentioned 97. It isn't the same landscape as 97, is it?
No, it's not. But I think, you know, there are obvious commonalities, the most obvious one being the fact that people are just fed up to the back teeth of a government that's been in power a long time and doesn't actually seem to have delivered. And in some ways, things are worse now for the Conservatives than they were back then, because if you remember, by 1997, the economy had actually been recovering for about 4 years. And, you know, it was going great guns. I mean, the inheritance that Blair and Brown took on from Major and Clark was actually quite positive. But now, obviously, we're seeing, you know, not only that people are fed up to the back teeth with a government that's been there too long, but they are still suffering from the so-called cost of living crisis. And of course, there are a lot of people with mortgages who are finding that Liz Truss's experiment has cost them dear. And in fact, there's been some research recently that I was looking at, which suggests that in constituencies where more people have mortgages rather than own outright, Labour are doing, you know, much better than they are in constituencies where there are more, if you like, homeowners who already have paid off their mortgage. So I think, you know, we can't understate the extent to which, you know, Liz Truss's experiment has actually had a tangible impact on people, not just a psychological impact.
Although I wonder whether, you know, give it time, whether we would have seen the same impact. I mean, you know, there's no doubt interest rates would continue to rise.
I think the problem is for the Conservatives that, you know, however unfairly or fairly people associate that rise with Liz Truss, And the other point I was going to say, and it's something that, you know, we are still in some ways ignoring, partly because I think the Conservatives have such a hold on the print media, that people are really, really worried about what's happening in the NHS as well. You know, the Conservatives would like to keep the conversation on migration, on small boats, et cetera, but, you know, if you talk to your, you know, friends and family, as I'm sure you do, and as I'm sure the listeners do, you know, you will hear tales of people, you know, having to queue up in the early morning to desperately try and get a GP appointment, being on waiting lists for ages and ages. And, you know, in as much as the NHS is, you know, what one Conservative once called, you know, the secular religion in the UK, you know, that actually has a very important electoral impact as well, which we shouldn't forget. So it's not just the economy, stupid, it's also the health service.
And this is all just going to get worse, isn't it, over time? I think Rishi Sunak has this hope that if he delays for as long as possible, things will improve.
A black swan event, perhaps, before November.
Well, no, it's the plan. It's the plan, because the plan is working, we're told. And he's doing the right thing, in inverted commas, and we are all going to appreciate that. And I saw an interview with him recently saying, you know, people don't want an election. I'm not really quite sure on any of this what planet he's on, but it's not going to improve, is it? Because even if interest rates come down, mortgages are still going to be a lot more expensive than they were. Inflation might slow, but prices are still higher. People are still out of pocket. No one is going to feel materially better off by the end of this year.
And even on his own tests, they're not working. I mean, it's just feasible, I suppose, that he might have some flights to Rwanda before November. It's possible.
Yeah.
But beyond even that, there,
if he leaves that, that's another. There's so much political capital that's been spent on that. If he gets flights going off to Rwanda and it makes not one jot of difference, then he hasn't got a leg to stand on with that either. So it doesn't look like he's playing very smart with any of this, is he?
No, and I mean, I think this, you know, prompts the oft-heard criticism about Rishi Sunak that he's just not very good at politics. I mean, I think, you know, he rather, you know, overconfidently came up with these, I think it was five pledges, wasn't it? You know, hardly any of which are being met. And the only one that is being met, obviously, is a return to growth. You know, we might see that as we come
inflation
out.
Inflation is down a bit.
And inflation is down, but of course, that's not his fault. But on stopping the boats, that's clearly not going to happen. As you say, whatever happens with flights going off to Rwanda, and I think stopping the boats is what matters to people, not flights to Rwanda. And on the health service, you know, he's not really managed to do anything about waiting times and waiting lists either. So, yeah, as you put it, even on his own terms, he's failed quite badly. You know, those pledges ended up being hostages to fortune.
So the electoral impact of that, if we imagine an election October, November, without something very dramatic changing in some form, which we can't see, are the Tories, do you think, heading for a wipeout, or perhaps for as bad a result as Labour had last time, you know, the worst since 1932 or whatever it was?
Yeah, worst since 1935. I mean, I'm still sceptical about a really, really huge Labour majority. I mean, partly because I guess, you know, 2019 was such a bad result.
Coming back from a very bad situation.
Yeah, it would be quite incredible, I think, for a party to turn round, you know, a bad defeat like that into a landslide win. But, you know, having said that, I mean, stranger things do happen. I'm not going to put a number on it. I'm always tempted to, but I'm not going to.
It's just us. Go on.
You sometimes, you go back to 1997 and it was, what, 179 majority? I mean, and we're getting, you know, forecast by some, you know, very enthusiastic Labour people now that it could be even higher than that. I mean, I find that quite difficult to believe. But equally, I mean, I do find it difficult to see how the Conservatives managed to turn this situation around. I mean, I was reading Stephen Bush in the FT today, and he said, you know, the only solution to the Tories' problem is basically time travel. And Rishi Sunak's not going to find a TARDIS in the bottom of the garden in Downing Street.
Well, maybe that's why he's delaying. Maybe he's waiting for it. That's part of the plan.
But the weakness that you're identifying there, Tim, is not so much the Tories, haplessness almost. It's Labour weakness potentially, because I think that was something that seemed to me to be coming out of the local election results, and we take on board that, you know, the limit to what you can say. But for example, the Gaza issue. Now, okay, it's probably in certain parts of the country, But it showed that there is a weakness, perhaps, to the Labour vote that might come into play in the general election.
Yeah, I mean, it's possible, and I think it has spooked some people in the Labour Party. But having said that, the alternative argument is, well, actually, Labour could afford to lose an awful lot of votes to, you know, the people who are angry about Gaza, and yet still win in those constituencies, simply because they have such big majorities. And I guess in terms of sort of something turning up, you could say, well, if, I mean, it's big if, obviously, there is a ceasefire in Gaza, and, you know, even if that ceasefire manages to be somehow made permanent rather than temporary, then, you know, that is going to help an awful lot. There are things that perhaps Labour and Keir Starmer can do to, you know, reforge links with some in a Muslim community. But of course, it isn't just people who are angry over Gaza. I mean, there's an extent to which Labour also lost some people to the Greens. And I think, you know, there is a degree of disappointment on the part of some, you know, left-wing people with the way that Starmer has taken the Labour Party, which, you know, could cost them some votes. And that might actually mean that they have difficulty in preventing the Greens taking a second parliamentary seat in Bristol. You know, they've got one down in Brighton. You know, they might hold on to that. And I think Bristol actually looks quite difficult for the Labour Party. So we shouldn't, you know, just say it's about Gaza. I think it is in part, you know, due to the fact that some people think that Starmer has taken the party in a kind of overly Blairite direction. And, you know, they're going to object to that.
So, yeah, and yet, you know, he has said, well, we're going to renationalise the railways. I mean, there's strangely not made a bigger thing out of it, because it seems like bleeding obvious, because they're being renationalised by default anyway, as these things all fall apart. I mean, if he was bold, he'd be saying...
The water companies.
And you would have thought that would be a surefire winner. And yet he doesn't want to go there.
Well, I mean, I suppose he doesn't want to go there partly because, you know, people worry about the expense of a renationalisation when it comes to water. I can understand that. But, I mean, you know, I think there is some worry at Labour circles about the extent to which this cautious approach, you know, it seems to be ruling out anything that a Labour government can do to change things and to signal to people that actually... you know, electing a Labour government will, you know, see a big improvement in their lives and actually see, you know, British politics and the British state alter quite fundamentally. I mean, whether you can go into an election not promising too much and then be more radical when you actually, if and when you actually manage to win, is a moot point. I mean, I think
it's the alternative to campaigning in poetry and governing in prose. It's the other way about.
But I wonder how radical it is, though, because I mean, the idea, and you're right. The reason he doesn't want to do it is because of the massive investment that would be required in getting the infrastructure up to speed. But in terms of it's not that radical. If you ask most people, even Tory voters, I think, to say, well, okay, should we bring water back into public hands? Given that we are, you know, the only country in the world which has actually completely privatised water and sewage, the only country, you would have thought you'd be on fairly safe ground.
You would, but, you know, it's all part of not spooking, you know, the financial markets. And I think actually, in some ways, although the Tories have been scarred electorally by what happened to Liz Truss, I think Labour has been scarred too. I think, you know, the fear is that, you know, the bond markets, whoever you want to personify as the villain in this scenario, you know, can make you pay for doing anything too radical too quickly. And I think in Rachel Reeves, Labour have got, you know, an inherently cautious, quite, you know, traditional, fairly orthodox economist there who isn't going to want to kind of scare the horses, in the belief that in the end, actually economic stability to some extent is the key to growth. Whether she's right or not is another matter.
She is very orthodox, and she could almost be in the Tory party, I think.
But the
Telegraph is this week been saying that, you know, that they think that the Tories should exaggerate how bad the economic picture is so that they would say, you know, choosing Labour is too risky. This is what which seems bizarre. So having a Project Fear right now, it's like it's too risky to their line of defence is that they could destroy the economy.
Because we messed it up so much ourselves.
Exactly, given, you know, look at the performance over their reign.
But what about, I mean, another thing, we've talked about Labour and its potential risks, but one of the big boosts potentially, Tim, and that's something that's happened in the last week or so, is what's been going with the SNP, because there's a lot of seats potentially in Scotland that have been SNP, is the sense of what's been going on, the weakness of the SNP now, could be the absolute trump card for Keir Starmer to get that massive majority, because they seem effectively electorally almost to have collapsed.
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, what's happening north of the border to some extent is similar to what's going on south of the border, in the sense you have got a government that's been there a very long time, in fact longer obviously in Scotland than is the case in the entire UK. It hasn't necessarily been able to deliver on some of the bread and butter issues that people really care about. And of course, you know, they have got their problems with the, you know, the whole scandal involving the you know, the former chief executive treasurer. You know, they've got leadership difficulties. Campervan gate. You know, and I think added, you know, together, that means that the SNP is probably on course maybe to lose about, you know, half of the seats it has to Labour.
Would they go to Labour? Is that the direction?
Yeah,
I think
there might be a few cases where, you know, possibly the Lib Dems benefit, but, you know, most of them will go to Labour. And, you know, Labour have made a very big push, I think, to recover from, you know, the dire situation in which they faced, which, to be honest, you know, was partly Labour's fault. I mean, I think they did take Scotland and Scottish seats for granted for a very long time. I don't think that's going to be the case now. And indeed, you know, probably won't be the case for a generation, given what happened when they lost all those seats to the SNP. I mean, how much difference, you know, sort of 20, 30 seats can make to Labour in terms of, you know, whether it'll be a huge landslide or whether it'll just be a comfortable win, I don't know.
They could seal it with a kiss, though, couldn't they? They could say, well, we'll have another referendum. Vote for us in Scotland. We'll allow another referendum. That would finish off the SNP.
I don't think that's going to happen.
This cautious look.
Although, I mean, one of the interesting things about Scotland, and I'm sure you've observed this before, and probably some of the listeners have as well, is that actually support for independence has not dropped that much. I mean, you have a really interesting situation which the main vehicle for independence, the SNP, seems to be, you know, out of favour big time. But yet, you know, we still have sort of 46, 47% of people saying they'd like to see an independent Scotland. So it's an interesting situation there. And obviously, it could be the case that were Labour to come into power and, you know, frustration were to grow in Scotland with, you know, the way the Labour were governing the UK as a whole, we might see another push for independence. We might see a revival of the SNP, but it doesn't look like that.
Yeah, when we were talking about Gaza before, I was thinking, I wonder how many people who would normally vote Labour might just not vote if they've taken exception to the way that they've dealt with the Gaza issue. And similarly, I wonder how many people who would normally vote Tory but are not very happy with this mob just won't vote. And whether we'll actually have quite a low turnout at the next election.
Yeah, I mean, turnout in the main, research suggests, is actually driven by two things. One are how close people think the election will be. And certainly if, you know, Labour is still 20 points ahead in the opinion polls in the run-up to polling day itself, I would expect that to impact pretty significantly on the turnout. And the other thing is the extent to which they think changing the government will actually make a difference to their lives and to the country. And again, you know, you've already talked about the kind of lack of enthusiasm that there is out there for Labour. We could see that depressed turnout as well. So, you know, on both of those counts, I guess one would expect it to be a fairly low turnout election. I mean, that doesn't sort of delegitimize the election, but, you know, it could be
significant.
Yeah, it could be. Yeah.
Is that then, you know, we're talking effectively then about a protest vote potentially being there, and perhaps the protest vote is not to vote almost, but also, one lot we haven't mentioned at all in this is the Reform Party, which had a very interesting, I mean, Blackpool obviously almost coming second, not quite. And some people say, well, they didn't get actually as many as they thought they would. But I mean, the implication is certainly that that is where a lot of very disgruntled Tories may go if they want to vote not Tory.
Yeah, and that obviously explains, you know, why there are so many people in the Conservative Party, Suella Braverman being the most obvious example, that, you know, are desperate for an even harder line on migration and on the culture wars in order to bring those people back. I mean, I think in terms of Reform's performance at the local elections, I mean, they didn't stand many councillors, so it's not easy to, you know, to talk about it in surefire terms. But it does seem to be the case that where they did stand The Conservative vote went down more than it did in places that they didn't stand. So that does seem to indicate that they are capable of taking votes from the Conservatives, and they don't seem to be taking any votes from Labour or other parties. So that is quite significant.
But how many people do they disenfranchise on the other side? So moderate Tory voters who will go, well, if you swing too far to the right, we're not going to vote for you.
That's always the trade-off, right? The Conservative Party faces. I was also going to add that Blackpool South, actually, to be honest, for all that they only finished 117 votes behind the Conservatives, was probably pretty disappointing for Reform, to be honest. I mean, if you think about left behind places, which might, you know, be, as it were, quite responsive to Reform's appeal, you know, that voted Brexit big time back in 2016, you would have thought the Blackpool South was sort of ideal Reform UK territory. And yet actually, you know, their share of the vote was only just above what they seem to be polling nationwide.
So you don't think they'll take any seats then? I mean, it's interesting. They say they're standing in all constituencies, although some of their candidates appear to be dead, which is not obviously ideal. But I mean, could they take a seat?
Famous last word, no, unless Nigel Farage stands, maybe. Maybe if Farage decides that actually, you know, the opportunities for making a buck in the United States in the run-up to the presidential election aren't as attractive as standing in, say, Clacton. You know, it's possible, but I rather
not that there's anything wrong with Clacton.
No, for our loyal listeners, there. Yes. You know,
literally, one of my best friends is from Clacton.
Is he really? Is he really? Or are you just saying?
Actually, Thorpe Lesoken, but it's not very far away from Clacton, so I'm going to say Clacton.
Yes. Near enough.
I rather suspect that Nigel Farage is more tempted now by the US than he is by the UK. I can't honestly see him, you know, standing again if he doesn't think he can win. And I do think Blackpool suggests that probably Reform is not on for, you know, doing as well in the election as they would hope to.
One thing Rishi Sunak is right on then, because he keeps on saying, well, you know, if you vote for Reform, then you are
wasting your vote.
He's, you know, vote Reform, get Labour. I mean, I think that is one of the, you know, the things that Sunak is saying that does actually make sense. I mean, I think the Conservatives are worried about that. But on the other hand, I mean, the Conservatives should be far more worried about losing votes to Labour than losing votes to Reform, but they are absolutely obsessed with losing votes to Reform. Well, and I think that tells you something about their minds.
Well, it's like Brexit all over again, isn't it? Really, we're going down a road which is being driven by an agenda which is trying to save factions in the Conservative Party.
Yes, I mean, I think that's right. I mean, I think obviously the kind of, you know, the hard right in the Conservative Party loves to point to Reform as a threat, because it's a way of, you know, using that as leverage to try and get the kind of policies that they want for the Conservative Party.
What about the middle? We haven't really mentioned the Lib Dems very much in all this. And if we've got, I mean, just looking across the country, if you have the general election, we know that in many parts of the South particularly, there is no real Labour structure in a lot of constituencies because they've never been potentially able to win it. And the Lib Dems do have the structure. Are we going to see almost by default a considerable number of Lib Dem votes? Because they've been really off the agenda for a long time.
They have. I mean, I think, you know, we were talking earlier about sort of, you know, uniform swing. I mean, the Liberal Democrats aren't doing particularly well in the opinion polls, but I think that's not what they're interested in right now, right? I mean, if they wanted to do well in the opinion polls, the Lib Dems could start talking about rejoining the EU, right? But actually, that wouldn't help them in what they really want to do, which is to win seats. And, you know, they are putting an awful lot of resource into target seats. You know, they aren't targeting too widely. You know, I think they know where they're strongest, and where they're strongest is often where there isn't actually much Labour opposition either. You know, and it's where, you know, they hope to take seats off the Conservatives. So some parts of the Southwest, you know, to the West and the South of London. You know, they have got, you know, a serious chance of maybe, you know, winning sort of 20, 30 seats if they go on as they are, I think, despite the fact that, as you say, you know, they don't appear to be doing particularly impressively in the opinion polls. But they have done reasonably well in these local elections, sort of under the radar. The Lib Dems, I think, were
quite successful.
They've
got more councillors than the Tories did overall, didn't they?
Yeah. And, you know, again, like Labour, they seem to be doing particularly well in seats that they need, or in places that they need to do well in order to win parliamentary seats.
So I wonder how much support we're going to see for the Conservative Party going up to this election in the press that has traditionally supported them, like The Sun, the Daily Mail, the Express, the Telegraph. So I see an editorial in The Sun, I love this, saying significant, well, first of all, they say, last week's results were a protest kicking the ballots for the Tories, and what they want is significant tax cuts and a crackdown on immigration. That's what's needed for Rishi Sunak to have any chance of success at the next election. So even if he does those things, has he got any chance at the next election at all? What could he do that's going to win it for him?
Well, I think that is a load of ballots, actually. I mean, the idea that, doing something more on immigration and tax cuts is going to do it, I think is just fantasy politics, to be honest. I mean, the Conservatives have already tried cutting national insurance a couple of times. You know, they're focusing on immigration all the time. It's impossible to imagine what else they could do on immigration, really, to get anything to happen between now and the election. And again, I mean, I think it is significant that, of course, you know, there's no mention made once again, and sorry to plug this point, of the NHS. You know, I mean, it's clear that, you know, that Rupert Murdoch and the people who run The Sun don't want to talk about that because it's not a great issue for the Conservatives. But then that does suggest that perhaps they are still going to support the Conservatives going to the next election, because they do anything
so?
Else.
I mean, there's been all sorts of suggestions in the background that maybe, you know, the massive ship is beginning to turn in some areas, because, I mean, you mentioned 97, and of course, famously, some of the Tory press did swing behind Blair.
They did. The Express did. That's
could that happen again?
The Express, The Sun, The Mail will never swing.
No.
For the Labour Party, the Telegraph will never do that. I can't see the Express doing it this time around. In fact, they might recommend a vote for reform. The Sun, maybe, but they don't seem particularly enthused by Keir Starmer and Rachel Reeves. And the fact is, look, I mean, you know, what the Sun says it, you know, its readers should do, you know, makes far less difference than it ever did. And even,
yes,
you know,
it's not the Sun what won it for a long time.
Yeah, I mean, that was always a myth in any case. And I think, you know, it's even more of a myth now when circulation is so much smaller. I mean, the effect that these newspapers have is indirect, in the sense that I think, you know, by banging on about particular subjects, they do frighten the BBC and other broadcasters into, you know, following that agenda rather than, the agenda that actually, from opinion polling, the public says is more important to them. So they do have an indirect effect, but the direct effects, I mean, you know, who cares really what the Sun tells people to vote to do?
I have to say, you had to dig down quite a bit in the Sun to actually see that story, because it's mainly, I mean, they seem to have pushed politics quite a bit further back. So how did we get here, Tim? How did we get to a situation where we've got, first of all, quite a bit of volatility happening in polls, but we also have two political parties that seem to be struggling to make any headway, ignoring the big issues, which, as you say, is the NHS, and being driven by an agenda like the reform agenda, like the Murdoch agenda, rather than, you know, the olden days when you'd have politicians and prime ministers who would be, touching those significant issues and actually do have a plan that does work. Unlike,
I think you're looking back with a bit of rose-tinted spectacles.
Well, maybe I am a little bit, but it just feels like on both sides we're a bit of a dead end.
There's a lack of an agenda. Is that a fair way of putting it?
Yeah, I mean, I think Labour will go hard on the NHS, to be honest. I mean, it did make me laugh this morning. I was reading the FT that, you know, Labour had accused Rishi Sunak of failing on the NHS. I think, you know, to be honest, they just pointed out that he's failed on the NHS. It doesn't take an accusation. I mean, I think, you know, you do have to go back to Jeremy Corbyn cratering the Labour Party's reputation, and it's still taking time, I think, to deliver that. They haven't chosen a particularly charismatic leader, it has to be said, and I think that does make a difference. I think people's perceptions of leaders, you know, do make a difference in terms of their enthusiasm for parties.
Is there anyone who you think could do a better job out of the Labour ranks?
No, I mean, I think, you know, in years to come, we might be looking at, say, Wes Streeting or somebody like that. But certainly, I don't think anyone could do a better job than Keir Starmer at the moment. So, I mean, in terms of the agenda, I mean, it is difficult. I mean, elections, you know, rarely focus laser-like on, you know, what the public say is important. You know, there's a degree to which both parties talk past each other and talk about those issues that are most important, or at least play best for them. And to be honest, I mean, your comment about rose-tinted spectacles is probably right. You know, 'twas ever thus to some extent. So we oughtn't to go away with the idea that, you know, previously things were so much better than they are now. I'm not sure that that's the case. Having said that, however, I do think, you know, people are, you know, now particularly cynical, particularly, you know, fed up and fatigued and, you know, lacking kind of confidence and enthusiasm for any of the alternatives. But that doesn't mean that that will stop Labour winning a reasonably large majority at the next election.
So on that, because we have to go, but final question on that cynicism. I mean, it does seem like he's going to hang on for as long as possible. Is he going to hang on to the start of next year, do you think? Because I would have thought that would just make people more angry. They'll just see him as squatting in number 10.
Yeah, I mean, I think that would be the dominant media narrative. And to be honest, we've already had one election that sort of nearly touched Christmas. I really don't think people would be grateful for one that actually ran right across the Christmas period. So, I mean, I would have thought November is the last possible moment, you know, realistically, that Rishi Sunak can go for.
And the earliest?
Well, I mean, October. He's in a bit of a catch-22 because if he wants it in October, he'd have to probably cancel the Tory party conference, which is a big money spinner for the Conservatives. Mm. But if he goes in November, then, you know, that will run across the American election and God knows who wants to be endorsed by Donald Trump.
there's a nice line to finish with.
That's if he's out of prison.
It's interesting, yeah. Yes. Oh, actually, the Trump lot have been saying how much they like, is it David Lammy? Bizarre. Weirdest of things. Anyway, yeah. Tim, thank you so much for doing for us.
No probs.
Really interesting. And, we'll come back to you, I'm sure, in due course. Tim, thanks.
Good talk, Tim.
Cheers, thanks a lot. Bye.
Bye.
So who knows?
Who knows? But we have a better idea.
I think we do.
A little bit.
I think we do know who our next Prime Minister is going to be, don't we?
But how much of that election, here's an interesting question, will be decided by new media, by social media, by the ways in which people believe stories online that they probably shouldn't, things that aren't true but get put up there.
So how much is it going to be false, fake news?
Very possibly. And how is that affecting our society? Because what we're going to talk about next week
This is the longest segue you've ever done.
No, it's a good one.
I'm going with it.
I noticed that. It's very valid because what I'm saying is social media is a bit of a Wild West. We know this. But for young people particularly, it's worse than that because you can get all kinds of awful things being seen, being said, that affect their lives in very dramatic ways. And we know so far that the social media companies, they shrug. They don't care.
Because if you're engaged, you're clicking, you're getting more ad dollars for them. So, why would they care?
And they're so big and so rich, they kind of don't need to worry about legislation in many cases, or perhaps feel they don't.
Yeah. And I think the government is, I mean, this is one thing that perhaps the government is right on. It was a government department, so I'm sure the approach probably wouldn't change too much, but with a change in government. But, there does need to be laws because they are not going to self-regulate. That is very clear.
But the laws have also got to have bite, because the problem is, as you say, they make loads of money, so in a way they don't really care about big fines particularly. It's got to be something pretty heavy. And it looks like the government, what's left of it, is moving in that direction. But is it going to be effective? Is that actually a way of doing it? Because people will find ways around these things.
Yeah. Well, through using what were they called?
Old man tries to understand modern technology.
Do you know, I used to work in the tech industry.
Yeah, right.
Anyway, people are
back in the days of Telegraph.
Anyway, they're spoofing their IP address.
There's all kinds of ways around it. And this is the problem, in a way, protecting young people from themselves. That sounds terrible, but that is effectively what's going to have to happen.
Yeah.
Because there's a feeling that people can easily access things that do them harm, immense harm, at an age when they're not capable of dealing with it.
Right, okay. Well, look, we'll talk about all of that.
We will.
And I'll get up to speed with the technology.
Yes, you wondered about that thing in the corner of the room. It's a television. You push a button, it comes on. It's extraordinary.
I have to say, I'm not 100% today because I've had this big work done on my teeth. So it's been a struggle getting through today.
But they're all your own, those teeth, aren't they?
Well, one of them's been...
You've got the receipts for them, is what you're saying.
They're all paid for, absolutely.
Right.
We'll see you next week on The Y Curve. Thanks for listening today.
The Y Curve.